Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the takeaway for Monday, May 22nd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Noel King from NPR's Planet Money, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We begin this hour alongside President Trump on his first official trip overseas. This past weekend, the president was in Saudi Arabia. Today, he'll be in Israel and then on to Rome, Brussels, and Sicily. In Saudi Arabia yesterday, the president gave a speech urging Muslim nations to join in the fight against terror. In a minute, we're going to look at the financial ties that bind the president to the Saudis. But first, the visit to Israel.
Donald, Melania, welcome. A very warm welcome to Israel.
On my first trip overseas as president, I have come to this sacred and ancient land to reaffirm the unbreakable bond between the United States and the State of Israel.
That was sound from a welcoming ceremony in Tel Aviv today. The visit comes at a time when the president's vision for America's role in the region is unclear. We're joined by Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich. He served as Israeli ambassador to the United States from 1993 to 1996. He's author of Yitzhak Rabin, Soldier, Leader, Statesman. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
With pleasure.
So this was supposed to be the easy part of President Trump's trip, but it looks increasingly like that might not be the case. The New York Times was reporting this morning that Prime Minister Netanyahu had to order some of his ministers to attend the airport welcoming ceremony because many of them were planning to skip it. What is going on there?
No. That's frivolous. The whole issue was about will there or there will not there be a handshake, and some ministers insisted that without a handshake, they won't show up, and Netanyahu instructed them to show up, and at the end of the day, there was a handshake. That really is a frivolous issue compared to the real issue of substance.
All right. What is the real issue of substance on this trip?
Whether President Trump will be able to restart an Israeli-Palestinian peace process or negotiating process. That is the single most important issue.
And what do we expect in terms of the next 36 hours? What will let us know whether or not the president is making progress?
Well, first of all, he will give a speech tomorrow, a major speech, and we'll need to see what the message in the speech is going to be. There will be meetings with the Israeli leadership and with the Palestinian leadership in Bethlehem, and we would be able, probably in 24 hours or so, to figure out whether a breakthrough has been achieved. But some things have been achieved even prior to arrival. Years ago, the United States was forced to choose our Arab friends, allies, or Israel. This time, there seems to be no problem. You can go to Saudi Arabia, and you can go to Israel, and you can talk about Israel and Saudi Arabia, and about Saudi Arabia in Israel. That is a much better time from this perspective.
All right, so that is a positive thing as far as you're concerned.
Exactly.
What would you like the message in the president's speech to be tomorrow? What would Israel like the message of that speech to be?
You know, beyond the familiar niceties and phrases that have been uttered so many times, Israelis would like to know how Israel fits into a larger vision for the Middle East. You know, nowadays, you can announce a huge arms sales to Saudi Arabia without Israel feeling that this is a threat.
Which the president did yesterday in Riyadh.
The president did, yeah. But the whole new tenor of American policy, what is to be expected with regard to Syria that is of great interest to Israel? And of course, what is the president's vision of an Israeli-Palestinian peace? He said many times during the campaign and since having been elected that this is the ultimate deal, the one he would like to make. Some Israelis, particularly on the right wing, are afraid that deals that are based on 50-50 compromises will not be favorable to them. So there is a great deal of curiosity, hopes, I would say, by center-left, and anxiety by the right wing.
President Trump, as you note, has called this the ultimate deal. He prides himself on making deals. But a peace agreement between Israelis and Palestinians has confounded generations of U.S. leaders. Does President Trump, in your view, have an edge? Does he have something going for him here that others didn't?
Well, what he has is, first of all, he's unconventional. He's new. And sometimes where the conventional has not worked for decades, the unconventional might work. Secondly, his temperament is by now well known here and in the region, and I don't think people or leaders want to antagonize him. That is an advantage. The question mark is, or two question marks is, one, whether his domestic problems will not overshadow his conduct of foreign policy, and secondly, whether he will have the perseverance, the patience to invest beyond effecting an initial breakthrough and then moving on. If it's going to happen, it will require sustained dedication.
Last question for you. We had news last week that President Trump divulged classified intelligence information to Russia that likely came from an Israeli source. Do you expect any tension over that during this visit?
No. First of all, this is a speculation. It's not been certified. And secondly, you know, among friends, slips and accidents happen. The relationship is much too precious for Israelis and also for Americans to let such an event, if it indeed happened, to cloud what could be a historic visit.
All right. Spoken like a diplomat. Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich served as Israeli ambassador to the U.S. from 1993 to 1996. He's author of Yitzhak Rabin, Soldier, Leader, Statesman. Sir, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We must be united in pursuing the one goal that transcends every other consideration. That goal is to meet history's great test, to conquer extremism and vanquish the forces that terrorism brings with it every single time.
That is President Trump speaking in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, on Sunday on the first leg of an extended overseas trip. The president urged leaders of Muslim nations who were present to join together in a fight against terrorism, a fight, he said, that will include the U.S. But security ties are not the only thing that bind the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The Trump brand has business ties to Saudi Arabia and also to Israel, where the president is today. Those ties were established long before Trump became president. Steve Eder is an investigative reporter at the New York Times. He's been looking into the Trump family's dealings in both countries.
You know, it looks like back in 2015, during the, you know, as the campaign for president on the Trump side was up and running, that the Trump executives had explored some type of deal, a hotel deal in Saudi Arabia. There were, you know, nothing was publicly disclosed or revealed about it at the time. And the first time it really came up was in some disclosures later that there were these corporate entities that had been formed, eight of them. Ultimately, those eight entities, the Trumps didn't pursue the deal, and the entities have all been canceled since. Still, there, you know, it shows that there was some interest, you know, at a time on the Trump side and, you know, possibly doing business in Saudi Arabia.
Why do you think the deal fell through?
Well, it's unclear what, you know, why it fell through. I think what we know about, you know, Trump Organization and the Trump hotel brand and some of their different endeavors is that they look far and wide, you know, at least before the presidency. Of course, you know, since the presidency, there's been the ban on new foreign deals, which, you know, has been, a big point, a big part of the ethics plan. But before that, I think executives were pretty open that their ambitions were to go global in terms of rolling out business opportunities and deals. And so, you know, they had all kinds of deals, I think, in the pipeline, you know, across the world. And some of them have been built. Some of them are in, you know, were in different stages. And some of them have been canceled.
The Times reported late last week that the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had helped to personally broker this $110 billion arms deal between the Saudi government and Lockheed Martin. Is that unusual, or since Mr. Kushner is a senior advisor to the president, is that just sort of standard procedure?
Well, it seemed unusual from past practice, from past administrations, you know, being that, you know, not only is Jared Kushner a senior advisor to the president. He's also the son-in-law. And so it sets up a little bit different dynamic, I think, especially when you're world leaders from different countries that are used to dealing in different kinds of ways. You know, it doesn't seem to be illegal, I think, you know, from our reporting, or raise any significant ethics concern. But it is certainly an unusual, I think, approach to these kinds of things. But I think also if you look at Trump, you look at Kushner, you look at the types of people there, their business histories or business people who sort of sold, you know, in terms of the campaign on business dealings, that seeing them in that negotiation setting maybe isn't quite as surprising.
President Trump is in Israel today. What do we know about his business dealings there?
I think unlike in Saudi Arabia, the business dealings in Israel have actually gone a little bit further. The Trumps have had an interest, you know, dating back over a decade in you know, getting involved in a tower project in Tel Aviv that at one point actually had a deal that was signed you know, to move forth that was in around 2006, 2007. The deal ultimately, you know, the tower wasn't built. It ended with the Trumps suing partners involved in that deal. Mm. There's been other, you know, licensing deals like with drinks over the years. And then more recently, the Trumps were in, I guess, you know, significant conversations about doing a tower deal in Tel Aviv again.
Does Jared Kushner have business deals in Israel independently of his father-in-law?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so very much the Kushners and Trumps operated separately in, you know, in terms of business. The Kushner company, Jared Kushner ran until his role in the administration back in January was you know, with the Kushner companies, his family's company. And they had deals. They had loans with Israeli banks and other dealings with Israeli families and business people. And he's stepped away to some extent from, you know, obviously stepped down and he's working in the administration. You know, although it wasn't a full divestiture of all of the assets, and so there's in some ways the Kushners probably have even deeper ties to Israel than the Trumps.
When the president first took office, there was obviously a lot of talk about potential conflicts of interest, given his history as a businessman. Do you think at this point we're looking at a president that is trying very, very hard to avoid any sort of anything that might implicate him, anything that looks like impropriety?
It's early to say, but I think that there is certainly a – you're not seeing President Trump at this point on this trip talking about – talking about past business deals and past, you know, discussing different things. I think it's a very tight, difficult line in terms of the ethics questions. These are going to be – because of the reach of the Trump businesses – this is going to be a, you know, question and something that we'll, you know, be continuing to look at from a reporting perspective, certainly, you know, over the time to come. But, you know, these are very delicate kinds of things. When there's past business relationships in a place and the potential for future business relationships down the road, there, it opens a, you know, different questions and different dimensions that are some ways unusual for the presidency.
Steve Eder is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. Steve, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Noel King, in for John Hockenberry, and there is breaking news from the Supreme Court today. Let's start with a quote. A state may not use race as the predominant factor in drawing district lines unless it has a compelling reason. So says Justice Elena Kagan. She was writing for the majority in a 5-3 Supreme Court decision that says two Democratic-held congressional districts in North Carolina were unconstitutionally drawn. According to this decision, Republican state legislators relied too heavily on race when they drew those districts. Here to tell us what this decision means for North Carolina and beyond is Rick Hassin. Rick is a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Rick, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So, Rick, what exactly does this ruling mean?
Well, this is the latest in a series of decisions where the Supreme Court has been asked to determine whether lines drawn by Republican legislatures, mostly in the South, were done unconstitutionally, what's called an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. And once again, I think this is the third time in a row the Supreme Court has found an unconstitutional racial gerrymander and made Republican legislators have to redraw their lines. This case is especially important because it seems to open up the ability to bring more claims like this by voting rights plaintiffs to try and get some of these Republican-drawn districts thrown out.
Is it always Republican legislators drawing the lines in these cases thus far? And is it always in the South of the United States?
So this cause of action for the unconstitutional racial gerrymander didn't exist until the mid-1990s when the Supreme Court, in a decision by Justice O'Connor, called Shaw versus Reno created this and said, when you separate voters on the basis of race without adequate justification, this is unconstitutional, regardless of whether it dilutes the votes. It sends a message that you shouldn't, that voters are being separated on a racial basis. At first, these cases were brought by conservatives to stop the expansion of Voting Rights Act created districts. Then the cases faded away, only to be brought back again this decade. And now you have voting rights plaintiffs and liberals using it to try to attack Republican legislatures. And almost all of these cases have been in the American South, where we have a situation where race and party overlap to a great extent. And so in North Carolina, as Justice Alito mentioned in his opinion dissenting today, 90% of African-American voters vote for Democrats, and a very large majority of white voters in North Carolina vote for Republicans.
How exactly are these congressional districts drawn? Are they drawn using census data? And how do the justices get a sense that they are being drawn unfairly, that they are relying on race? What does the map look like?
So the maps are drawn, in all of these cases, were drawn by the state legislatures in North Carolina. The General Assembly drew the districts. Two congressional districts were challenged in the decision that the court issued today. In one, the state said it had to pack African-American voters into this district to comply with the Voting Rights Act. And we've seen this pattern in Alabama and in Virginia. And the Supreme Court, again, third time now, said the Voting Rights Act didn't require this. You were using that as an excuse, and it is unconstitutional. The other district, District 12, that was challenged in this case, the question was, was this about race or was it about political party and which factor predominated? It's kind of a hard question to answer in the American South, where, as I've mentioned, the race and party correlate so well with each other. And what Justice Kagan said was the lower court, three judges, found that race predominated and we have to defer to that. But then the most interesting part of the case, in the footnotes of the case, she suggested that race and party in the American South can be proxies for one another when you have such a correlation between race and party. And that suggests that many more cases like this could be brought in the future where Republican legislatures discriminate against Democrats, which also means discriminate against African Americans.
That is very interesting. Talk to me about where else we might see this having a ripple effect in the United States. What specific areas of the country do you think could be the next states with districts challenged?
Well, there already is ongoing litigation in Virginia and in Alabama, both of those cases heard by the Supreme Court, now working their way through the lower courts. There's also another case in North Carolina involving the state house districts. A lower court found that the state General Assembly districts were a racial gerrymander, ordered special elections for 2017. Those were put on hold by the Supreme Court. Those might be called back into question. And I think Texas, where there is just has been a ruling that there's a racial gerrymander and a Voting Rights Act violation in Texas's congressional districts and Texas House districts. That case is heading to the Supreme Court, but now with this decision, maybe we'll see the lower court rethinking some of what it did and finding even more racial gerrymanders.
That's interesting. So it could be a first domino to fall situation. What, Rick, do you think this could mean for the 2018 midterm elections? What, if anything?
Well, 2018 is coming up. It may seem far away, but you know, it takes a long time to litigate these cases and draw districts. We might see some changes in districts in 2018. More importantly, I think these decisions will have an effect in the 2020 redistricting cycle that'll start after the census. And there, everybody has to redraw their lines. The Supreme Court said that since the 1960s to make sure the districts have the same size populations in them. And I think we're going to see more litigation, more attempts to try to argue that the lines that are being drawn are racial gerrymanders. And we've got a Supreme Court, potentially the Supreme Court, hearing a partisan gerrymandering case from Wisconsin. The court should decide by the end of the term whether it's going to hear that. So there's still a lot more litigation to go before the 2020 round of redistricting.
And it'll keep having an impact, it sounds like, until 2020, possibly through 2020. What happens now in North Carolina? What do Republican legislators have to do now?
Well, they've already redrawn the lines. They claimed when they redrew the lines that they were doing it for partisan, not racial means. That has been challenged. That's up on appeal at the Supreme Court. That will probably be sent back. And so there's more litigation in North Carolina, and it's going to continue for the next few months at least.
All right, Rick, I have a feeling we'll be talking to you again soon. Rick Hassin is a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Rick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In the weeks leading up to the 2016 election, the FBI and local police in western Kansas foiled a terror plot by three members of a white supremacist group called the Crusaders. The three men, who go on trial this June, had planned to bomb an apartment complex whose residents were mostly Somali refugees. Those refugees had been living and working in the small meatpacking town of Garden City, Kansas. News of the planned attack rattled the Somali community, but not one family left Garden City.
I think that Garden City is one of the more hopeful places that I've visited in these sorts of towns.
Ted Genoese is an award-winning writer and editor who spent years reporting on meatpacking towns like Garden City. His article, just published in the New Republic, describes a rural community that has sometimes struggled with its reliance on immigrant labor.
When all of this began, the community was sort of on a downhill slide and was struggling to keep its economic base. So the arrival of new people who were coming with sort of guaranteed income and therefore some money to spend in the community and support local businesses was seen as something that was something of a boon. You know, the town's population went from about 16,000 to 25,000 in a matter of just a few years.
Wow.
On the one hand, there were sort of the civic leaders and the business leaders who saw this as a positive. And then there were people who felt that they were being squeezed out of those economic opportunities that would be created by the meatpacking plants, who started to develop a kind of simmering resentment toward the immigrants.
And that simmering resentment, of course, leads into this attempt or this plot to massacre Somali immigrants. There were three men involved in this plot, three men arrested. What do we know about them?
It's an interesting trio. They found each other through a kind of combination of attending militia meetings, these white supremacist groups that we think of as being common for quite some time in rural areas. And these guys all found each other through some of those groups, both in person and online. There was Curtis Allen, who was an Iraq War veteran who had come home suffering from PTSD and from a traumatic brain injury, who seems to have developed a hatred for Muslims while he was in Iraq. There was Patrick Stein, who was a farmer and through online means had kind of self-radicalized and believed every single paranoid conspiracy theory that he read online. And then there was Gavin Wright, who in some ways remains the mysterious member of the group. People, you know, describe it as being someone who had some strong conservative beliefs, but no one suspected of these sorts of things.
What were they plotting exactly, and did they have the means to carry it out?
Early on, there was discussion of the apartment complex where many of the Somalis lived, that they would, you know, blow up the mosque during prayer time. There was talk of simply going into the apartment complex and shooting everyone that they saw. Over time, they started to plot this idea of a Timothy McVeigh-style car bombing. And there was at first an idea of doing this on September 11th, but then when there was concern from the group that such an attack might be an aid to Hillary Clinton in the last days of the presidential campaign, they decided to push it off to election night.
How were these three men caught?
The FBI, they had been following these guys at least since the spring of 2016, but everything sort of accelerated in the investigation and came to a head when Curtis Allen's girlfriend, after a domestic violence incident, called the police and she showed them that their trailer was loaded with ammunition and guns. And the final police report estimated that there was a metric ton worth of ammunition and weapons there.
How did the Somali community respond when they were told about this plan? I imagine people must have been terrified.
At first, you know, I think it was shock and fear, but I really do have to give great credit to the Garden City Police Force and particularly to Chief Michael Utes, who had worked in this community and knew that understanding the immigrant community is vital to doing good police work. He felt that there hadn't been enough outreach to the Somali community and started establishing that in the months before the arrests were made. So he was able to reach out to the leaders in the Somali community and gather them together at the police station so that they could find out about this all at once. And with the FBI present, giving full and accurate information
And it really prevented the spread of panic and misinformation that could have led to people just picking up and fleeing.
Hmm. What is the political climate like in this part of Western Kansas? I mean, as you point out in your story, this is happening right around the time of the 2016 presidential election.
Well, it really is the central mystery of this whole case, as far as I'm concerned. At the local level, the citizens of the community have more or less consistently elected forward-thinking liberal members of the city council and mayors. And yet the city itself and the county that it sits in and the surrounding counties not only voted for Trump, but voted for him about 2-1. So there's this divide between what people see and trust on their own streets and in their communities and what they fear coming from state and national politics. And Trump, very specifically in the months that were leading up to the election, was singling out not just Syrian refugees, but Somali refugees as a group that was in particular to be distrusted and that were potential terrorists. And so it has created a really kind of schizophrenic identity in a town like Garden City.
And one that I think we're probably seeing in many similar towns across the United States. Do you think in the end the people of Garden City are going to be all right? Has the city come together in the wake of all this?
In the wake of this attack, the police and the Somali community pulled together. I also think that the Somalis deserve tremendous credit because they kept insisting and still insist that while they were the target of the attack, that the apartment complex they live in is also filled with Burmese refugees, refugees from Vietnam, and immigrants from all over Latin America. And they've said, you know, we can't say that we were the only ones who would have been the victim of this attack. And so they've done a lot of work to reach out to those communities and to see themselves not as a Somali community within Garden City, but the Somali part of the Garden City community.
Ted Genovese, thank you so much for bringing it to us.
Thanks for having me on.
Ted's story, which was published in The New Republic, was written in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network. This is The Takeaway. I'm Noelle King, in for John Hockenberry. For the second time this month, the Department of Justice has filed a lawsuit against the country's biggest health insurer, UnitedHealthcare. The suit involves allegations of Medicare fraud. And here's what's going on. Medicare serves 50 million elderly and disabled Americans. About 16 million of those people are enrolled in a program called Medicare Advantage, which is administered by private insurers. It was set up as a way for the government to save money, but there are allegations that UnitedHealth fudged their clients' medical histories. They made people look sicker than they actually were, and in doing so, the insurance company reaped more than $1 billion in profit from the government and from taxpayers. Fred Schulte is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. He's been covering the story in depth and says the case rests on what United knew and what they chose to report.
The Justice Department is alleging that United knew about examples in which they had been overpaid and examples in which they had been underpaid, and they decided only to report the examples in which they were underpaid. I think that the industry would argue that, you know, nobody wants to leave money on the table, and you want to make sure that you're coding so that you can maximize the amount of reimbursement you get. I mean, and nobody would argue with that. That's simple business sense. But if you go over a certain line and you're aware that there's all kinds of problems with the coding that you know about that's resulted in really, really high overpayments to your company, and you just kind of keep quiet about that. And meanwhile, you complain to the government, you know, you didn't pay us enough for all these other cases, and you just ignore the other ones. So that's where this case hinges on.
One interesting thing that your reporting has turned up is that these allegations are coming often from inside of the insurance companies themselves, right? They're coming from whistleblowers. Why do you think that is? Is there no oversight from outside of the program?
The reason that the whistleblowers are insiders in the company is those are the ones that know that this is going on. This is something that's almost totally invisible to the public. If you're a person on Medicare, you don't have any idea that you have this risk score and that Medicare is being paid a certain amount on your behalf, because you don't, you know, they don't tell you that, and the government doesn't tell you that. And I think that there have been many critics of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which runs this program, that they haven't very aggressively police this. You know, it's an interesting area because more and more the government's been releasing payment data of, you know, how much doctors got paid, how much hospitals got paid, how much medical devices got paid by Medicare, in order to give the public a better understanding of how the program works and how much it costs. But when it comes to Medicare Advantage, there's been very little of that.
So the significance of the Department of Justice getting involved is that now we actually know what's going on. Before, we didn't.
Right. And when the government takes over the case, it kind of ups the ante significantly because, you know, if you're somebody that worked at an insurance company and you become aware of something that you think is a fraud, you have to take on that huge company basically by yourself. But once the Justice Department gets involved, and they have a lot more resources, and so there's a lot more pressure on the company to address this.
Given all of the trouble, is there any kind of national push to overhaul Medicare Advantage?
Not really. I mean, Well, there's been some people in Congress that have asked questions about the payment scheme, but the Medicare Advantage program pretty much enjoys broad support in Congress, and there's not many people saying that it's inherently that there's something wrong with it, or that there's something wrong with having private companies involved. But, I mean, I think most people, whether you're a consumer advocate or just, you know, an average taxpayer, you might wish that somebody's watching to make sure that they're not ripping us off.
Fred Schulte is a reporter for Kaiser Health News. Fred, thank you so much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
A story about what happens when a presidential administration changes and priorities change with it. Earlier this month, dozens of farm workers in California's Central Valley got very sick with nausea and vomiting. Their illness was tracked to a pesticide called chlorpyrifos. This pesticide has been under review by scientists for many years, and back in 2015, the Environmental Protection Agency decided to ban it. But before the ban could take effect in April, the new head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, reversed the ban. He said thousands of American farms rely on chlorpyrifos. Dana Boyd-Barr is a professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. She has been studying this pesticide for years. She was a member of an EPA-appointed scientific advisory panel that recommended the ban. She didn't take part in the decision because the panel was considering her research. Dana, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is chlorpyrifos? What is it used for?
It's an organophosphate pesticide, and organophosphate pesticides have a similar mechanism of action in the body as nerve agents. So sometimes they're called junior strength nerve agents. But it's a very effective insecticide that's used in agriculture across the U.S. and other places as well.
So this is primarily used on farms?
Yes. It used to be used residentially, but back in the early 2000s, its uses in the home were banned.
All right. So you say nerve agent, and justifiably or not, I get very nervous. What did your research find out about chlorpyrifos?
Well, my research and a lot of other research that complemented it found out that people who were exposed to chlorpyrifos during pregnancy actually had neurocognitive delays, earlier onset of ADHD, and decreases in their IQs.
So that seems like a fairly good reason for recommending a ban. How did you feel when the new head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, reversed it?
I was dumbfounded. I've been studying this insecticide for about 30 years, and right now there are over 30 peer-reviewed scientific publications that implicate it in neurological deficits in children.
I want to give the other point of view a little bit of a chance here. So let me ask you, if we've been using this pesticide for many decades, isn't that evidence that it's fine, it's okay?
Well, I mean, we have a higher incidence of ADHD today. On an individual level, it's probably not that impactful. It might decrease your IQ several points, which wouldn't be noticeable for an individual. But when you look at it on a population level, you see a shift of the IQ such that more people are considered special needs people. Fewer people are considered in that high IQ range. And so that population shift is what's really important to consider here.
And I would imagine you're not saying that chlorpyrifos is responsible for all of that.
No, absolutely not. I think that it is documented that exposure to this does contribute to that.
Mr. Pruitt, the new head of the EPA, has said, look, thousands of American farms rely on this pesticide. What do you think about that argument?
I think that's true, but there are other pesticides out there that are just as effective that can be used. This is just one that's been proven effective over the years. I am concerned about the farm workers' children as well, people that participate in farm work with their parents, that they may have neurocognitive delays or may have some kind of adverse health outcome that's associated with these exposures during early childhood as well.
So what happens next? Is the ban officially dead?
I hope not. I mean, I hope that we can continue to provide evidence that it is indeed a harmful insecticide and that eventually whoever is in charge of the EPA will take the recommendation that the EPA has given and the recommendation of scientists who've been studying this pesticide for years.
Dana Boyd Barr is a professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. Dana, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Noel King from NPR's Planet Money, sitting in for John Hockenberry on The Takeaway today. Across the country, high school seniors are preparing to put on their caps and gowns and march into the future. Some of you probably have one of these anxious and ambitious young people in your own family. And here's some good news. High school graduation rates in this country have hit record highs. In 2015, 83% of U.S. students graduated from high school, which sounds great. But is it really? There is, some teachers argue, a big difference between passing subjects and being proficient in them. Proficiency refers to a student's skill level or mastery of knowledge, and there's no national standard that evaluates proficiency, which means two young people can graduate from high school but have very, very different levels of competence in a particular subject. Rob Barnett is a public school teacher in the Washington, D.C. school district, and he thinks we are putting way too much emphasis on graduation rates. Rob, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. I'm happy to be here, Noel.
All right. You say that this country is in the middle of an epidemic of passing. What do you mean?
What I mean by that is that there's a big gap in this country between the number of students who are graduating from high school and the number of students who have shown through, at least through test scores, that they really understand the things that we want them to understand from high school. I think in my own district and in other places in the country, the default for students has been to pass them along year after year and have them march up to graduation without really stopping to check, have they learned the things that we want them to learn. What everyone wants in the education system is for students to be successful and feel successful. And there's a lot of people working really hard towards that goal, but it can be very challenging at the end of a school year when a student has learned some of the content, but not all of the content. It's challenging to determine should that student be, quote unquote, held back and made to repeat the content, or should the student move forward maybe with some gaps in understanding. I think, at least in the District of Columbia, we have a standard that we want students to meet, but they don't meet it, and we don't ask them to go back and meet it. We just send them along.
You have written a lot about this, and you use an example that I think is particularly powerful. You have a student whom you call Robert, and you say, look, Robert is a very sweet kid. He tries hard when he's in class, but he has a lot going on outside of class. His mom is struggling. He's responsible for his little sister, and so he is not getting the material. And as a teacher, that leaves you with a decision. Do I punish this very well-meaning kid who has a lot of external factors contributing to his inability to maybe grasp or be proficient in what I'm teaching?
Yeah, it happens all the time. He might miss a couple weeks at a time, and so he misses something that I as a teacher and we as a school system want him to learn, but then he'll come back, and when he's in class, he's a great kid. at the end of the year, it's hard to tell him you need to stay back and repeat, but it's also hard to send him along when he has missed what may be essential bits of knowledge or skills.
Rob, what do you teach?
I teach math and computer science.
Okay, so subjects where proficiency is clearly very important.
Absolutely, yeah. I see great kids in the 12th grade, and sometimes they don't know how to do basic division. And I think it's because they've been passed along so many times. Not only have they missed certain skills, but they've also developed the mindset that math is something that's beyond their comprehension. It's hard for them to understand. You can't really understand 12th grade math if you haven't understood the subjects and skills leading up to it.
Is there a conversation at all in your school? You're a 12th grade math teacher. You've got kids being kicked up who are not proficient. Do you ever go to the 11th grade teachers, the 10th grade teachers, the 9th grade teachers and say, please stop sending these kids up if they're not ready?
Sure. We say that all the time, but the 9th grade teachers would say that to the 8th grade teachers and the 7th grade teachers and the 6th grade teachers. And something I've struggled to figure out is that we have some fantastic teachers at my school who work extremely hard and are extremely good at what they do, but we are all trying simultaneously to teach the content of our grade level and fill in gaps that have developed over the years, and it feels impossible sometimes.
Do you have any students this year that you've had to fail?
I do, yes, and it is a really hard decision to make when a student wants to walk across the stage with his or her class, but you know, my job is to teach students math and teach them skills about being a student and being accountable, being responsible. And when a student doesn't meet those bars, sometimes I do have to tell a student, not yet.
Give me a sense of the emotion that goes into making that decision, both on your part and some of the things that you've heard from students who, I'm sure, as seniors, just want to get out.
Yeah, that is often the overwhelming desire of seniors and of families and also of school districts is to get students out. What I try to tell students is we're not just looking to push you across the stage when you turn 18. We're looking to teach you things because we believe they're important and we believe they will help you to achieve what it is that you want to achieve in your life. But it's a really hard emotional conversation, and it was one that I wish I didn't have to have.
What do you think would be a good fix for all of this? I mean, this is an entrenched and obviously widespread problem that you're talking about here.
Yeah, it is absolutely entrenched, and I think it is almost inherent in the design of our school system, in which students will take a course for an entire year. They will inevitably learn some things and miss other things, and then they face this binary choice between advancing to the next grade level or staying back. And for a student like Robert, neither of those is a good choice. What I think we should do is reorient our school system so that instead of grouping students and moving students based on their age, we group students and move students based on their knowledge, understanding, or what I call mastery. So for a student like Robert, he would work on one set of math topics, and once he has shown that he's mastered those, he would move on to the next. He could do that as fast as he like if he picks things up quickly, or he could do that as slowly as he likes if he has challenges going on at home or other aspects of his life. But what's key is that he will actually learn the things that we want him to learn.
So tailoring more to the individual student.
Absolutely. And this is something that previously would have been impossible to do. I'm a teacher that has sometimes 25 or 30 students in a room. So how can I teach to 25 or 30 individual paces? But with technology and video instruction and online learning, it's actually much easier for students to move at their own paces and learn in more individualized ways.
Rob Barnett is a public school teacher in the Washington, D.C. school district. Rob, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
This is Ava calling from Canton, Massachusetts, to the class of 2017. Work hard and accept that you may fail. Don't give up. Save money and stick to a budget.
My name is John. It's Cranberry Lake, New York. Stay active in your community. Run for an office. A difference happens by one person doing something.
As you travel forward in life, teach your children to love and respect all creatures, both human and non-human.
Be strong in the face of adversity. Always tell the truth. And believe that in the end, justice will always prevail.
Life begins outside your comfort zone. Don't be afraid to be a bit uncomfortable. After all, you were uncomfortable when you left your mother's womb.
Be open to and respectful of the diversity of opinions, because while yours may indeed be a righteous one, it most assuredly is not the only one.
Instead of complaining, ask for help and take feedback. Always remember, you don't know everything, and that's okay. Congratulations.
Do you have advice for the class of 2017? We want to hear it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Noelle King from NPR's Planet Money, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time. Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.